You bet.
Concur.
We don't need any more of these.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's NSF Live, our weekly show where we talk about all things spaceflight and answer your questions about the topics that happened recently. This week, we have some upcoming debut launchers, a crew launch, and as always, our big Starship section at the end. My name is Adrian Beil. I'm a writer and commentator for NSF, and with me today are assistant managing editor for NSF, Chris Gebhardt. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. How about yourself, Adrian?
I am doing perfect. I'm really excited for this night because with the crew launch coming up later, it's going to be one interesting night for sure. And also with us today, it's a writer and commentator and a lot of other things, Alejandro Alcantarilla Romera. Alex, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I saw you try there with my name. I'm not going to be asking people to perfectly pronounce it, but yeah, I'm doing great. Really excited for this upcoming week of you know, activity with three launches potentially tomorrow and all of the stuff that we have to talk about today as well.
Yes, for sure. We will dive right into it because we have a lot of topics today we want to talk about. And as always, make sure to tag at NASA Spaceflight in chat for your questions. We will answer the questions that are related to the topics we are just discussing. So, for example, if you have a Starship question, maybe hold onto that until we are coming to the Starship section. So let's start with the topics we have today. And the beginning of this week started with an acquisition. VAST has acquired Launcher. Chris G., you want to give us an overview about that?
Yeah, so if you remember, one of our polls at the beginning of the year, just a couple of weeks ago, right, Adrian, was what were some of the major takeovers or buyouts or acquisitions that we were expecting in the industry? And this is probably an example of one of the smaller but potentially really consequential acquisitions. So VAST was a company that was only founded last year in 2022 with an aim of building an artificial gravity research station, as well as free-flying modular zero-gravity space stations in low Earth orbit. And the specific idea behind their artificial gravity station was that it was going to be 100 meters or 333 feet long. And at the ends of it, as it spun, it was going to provide Earth sea level gravity. And then as you worked your way in toward the center, you would eventually arrive at Mars gravity and then lunar gravity. So it would serve as a test bed for multiple different potential destinations in the solar system, but also as an important test bed for how artificial gravity now affects the human body, right? Because we're understanding through the International Space Station how microgravity affects the human body, but what about artificial gravity? You know, we haven't really studied that. So that would be an important part of that. So as part of this overall plan to do that, VAST was looking to do that as quickly as possible and acquire the talent that they really needed. And they looked at Launcher and saw a lot of that talent there. And so they approached Launcher and acquired them and bought them out. And right now the plan for the company, which is VAST, is that they will take Launcher's orbiter vehicles that were under development, and they'll continue to use them to test the technology that they need for their artificial gravity space station, as well as other space tug technology customers, and space tug customers that are out there. Development, very critically, on the E2 engine will also continue. However, the launch vehicle that Launcher was planning will not continue now under the new acquisition. Position by VAST. However, the CEO of Launcher, Max, will become the president of VAST. So there is good synergy there. And the press release specifically noted that the employees of Launcher are now employees of VAST. They didn't actually note any layoffs, but just that the team expanded to include everyone, basically. That's what the release says. I can't speak to the firm reality of that, but at least it sort of signifies a synergistic coming together of these two companies rather than you're doing what we're doing, so we're going to buy you so you can't do that anymore. And I think that's a really important element, which is why I think this could be a very smaller scale acquisition that could really have a large scale payoff here.
Yeah, it really feels like they, these orbital tug technology, they really wanted that. I mean, have they indicated at all if what launcher they might use in the future for the upcoming missions, since they will not use this?
They They have not entirely said just that just yet, and not surprising given where they are in the early stages of development for that space station. You kind of need to have a little bit more. I mean, like, the renders look cool and everything, but you really need to have an idea of what the station is actually going to be built with. How many modules is it going to be? What type of construction and outfitting might you be using? Even though a lot of that can be automated now, because a lot of stuff that used to be that we used to have to put outside the International Space Station because it was so big can now go inside. The Axiom module additions to the ISS are a good example of that. So once you sort of have all of that, then you can look at, okay, what are the vehicles that are available that could do that? Based on how big they sort of want this thing to be, a couple of options really jump to mind. Starship, New Glenn, and Vulcan are distinct possibilities for the launch vehicle for this station. And its various components.
It's also indicating how far this might be out with the just named rockets, because none of these three rockets so far has flown. So
although two likely will this year, within a couple months of each other. So yes.
Yes, it's definitely an interesting choice, but it also shows how much movement there is on the launch market as well. So,
now, the other thing I would say, too, with the station is don't also discount the possibility of inflatable technology and inflatable modules, which have been tested on the ISS and in pre-flight orbit with Genesis, Beam on the ISS and Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 in orbit.
Then let's hope they... I really think this is one of the good acquisitions, because it doesn't feel like one of the acquisitions that some people would fear, I think, right now in space, which is more like companies buying companies that are in financial trouble. This feels more as like a acquisition where they just they thought it made sense, so they went with it. But this wasn't like, oh, they're struggling, let's just take them in. So this feels more like a good acquisition to me, and not of the ones that are more consolidation of markets and segments. So I like that. I have two questions here. One is more general. Why do we say microgravity for the ISS instead of zero G?
Because it is not zero G. Essentially weightless. Essentially, you are so close to zero gravity that you could call it that. But in the true scientific sense, Earth's gravity is still tugging on the ISS. The sun's gravity is still tugging on the ISS. The moon's gravity is tugging on it. I mean, heck, even Mars, Jupiter, Saturn will all tug on it in various ways with n-body physics. So it's close enough for the scientific purposes that we need, but it's not truly, so we call it microgravity.
There we go. So like basically difference are very little, but it's a technical difference.
Which makes all the difference in science experiments, yes.
I think I'm going to reference Shuttle here, by the way. I think even the direction in which your station is oriented at some points is affecting that as well, because gravity changes along the radial, basically from bottom to top in that direction. It changes a little bit, but it doesn't change as much on the other direction, basically horizontally to the ground. And so I think on some shuttle missions, they had the shuttle oriented in some orientation precisely so that the experiments wouldn't notice as much variations of gravity along its orbit. And I think that is
also true. Gravity gradient orbit. You basically aimed the engines down. It was engines down at the ground. And that's how you imparted, I think it's a 1.4 degree per minute rotation is what you need to maintain that orientation as you orbit the Earth every 90 minutes or so. And yes, that is the exact orientation and reason they would get into that for some of the biological experiments. Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah.
There we go. The shuttle reference bingo card. You can all mark that on your board. We have another question by Christian here. What orbit will they use for? Do they already said that about their potential like station, which orbit they will do?
No, and perhaps a bit premature for that one. But it's going to depend on the launch vehicle you eventually choose, the number of modules or number of launches you need, and also what you're trying to do with that station. Because we'll just use Kennedy Space Center as the reference. If you launch from there, right, the most efficient orbit to get into is 28.5 degrees, because that's the latitude of the launch site. So that's the easiest. But if you go to that orbit, you can't see the poles. So if you're trying to entice customers in a wide variety of scientific, you know, to leverage the station in scientific observations of Earth, you would probably want a higher inclination orbit, 57, which is achievable from the Cape. Also the polar orbits, because Jack's not here. So I'll mention them now from the Cape. So it just sort of comes down to what you want the overall business case for the station to be, because you can mimic Mars, Earth, and lunar gravity by spinning the station, and inclination doesn't play into that.
Certainly an interesting topic, and I'm really curious how this all will develop, because I feel like this artificial gravity topic is something that always comes up a lot, especially in a bit more down the line scenarios, for example, for Mars travel. So it's really interesting to see how they will test that out. Now, a question here around the ISS, which is a related topic, I guess, here, which all come up of quite a lot today. When will the ISS actually retire? Is there already a timeline for that?
Right now, 2023 is the date that the international partners have agreed at this point to fund the International Space Station out to. There is a lot of thought that that would be it, and that will be the end, and we'll retire the ISS at that point. The plan, though, however, is that in the interim, 6 years, Axiom will add...
Is that 2023 or 2028?
Well,
I think you said 2023. Probably a miss.
Well, the ISS out to 2030. Sorry. I said 2023. Totally misspoke there. ISS out to 2030. There we go. Probably for the best to get that date right. Yes, ISS out to 2030 is about the end of what is currently planned through funding and agreements with the international partners. That can, of course, be extended, because it used to be 2016, then it was 2020, then it was 2024. Now it's 2030. However, Axiom's plan over the next 7 to 6 years is to add a series of modular complexes to the ISS. And then at the end of the ISS's life, those modules can be detached and become free flying on their own, and basically means no gap in low Earth orbit space station capabilities at the end of the ISS's lifetime in 2030.
There we go. And you thought you could just get a simple year answer here, but it's a complicated, as always. It's never just an easy answer in space. Last question here on this topic before we move on, because I said we have a lot of topics today. You said engine development would continue. What applications are they looking at for that now? Since they are no longer building a rocket, so why would they possibly continue engine development?
The in-space tugs are a lot of what they're looking at here, and in-space propulsion. So that's the development process.
There we go. Okay, let's move on to the next topic here, which is one. Let me just click yes. This is one that I think quite a few people are. I'm waiting for this, since it's an upcoming rocket launcher, which is Relativity with their Terran 1, which dropped an announcement video about their possible first flight date of their methane-powered rocket, which is March 8th, not that far away. It's a 3-hour launch window starting at 1 p.m. EST. And they will launch from Slick 16 at Cape Canaveral. So yeah, we are really getting into the methane time of launches here, with Terran 1 probably starting that season. And any thoughts on that, guys?
Well, I was going to say, this is an interesting one, right? Like, the Chinese rocket has already attempted but failed to reach orbit. So we've already had one attempt. So Relativity would be the second that we know of. Of course, its sequencing with Starship is still to be determined. But it is very interesting, because methane was so largely ignored as a fuel for so long. And now everyone, including KSP, is just turning to it, in almost in lockstep here for our future exploration plan. So it's really, it's going to be exciting to see who's first, honestly.
Yeah, it's, I think I said it somewhere the other day where people are like, oh, it's such an artificial like race. And I'm like, yeah, but it's an exciting one. It's a like, yeah. like a race that has no harm. It's just funny to watch to see who's the first methane rocket to orbit. There's of course no prize money. There's nothing behind this. It's just interesting to see. And I like that kind of race because there's no hard feelings attached to it.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, looks like there will be an attempt soon. Of course, there could be scrubs with the first attempt. And here we see them actually assembling their rocket, which of course has a high 3D printing factor involved, since that's their main selling point. So yeah. Question here about Terran 1. How will Terran R compare to Terran 1? So. Yeah, it's a very much different rocket with Terran 1 to Terran R, right, Chris?
Oh gosh, I guess the best way to describe this is it's kind of the difference between Falcon 9 and Starship if you just scale Starship down a little bit. But they're really, yeah. I mean, that's the best way, Alex. I mean, that's kind of how I would describe it.
Yeah, it's like the Terran 1 basically launches like a ton to orbit, but then Terran R is gigantic. It has the performance of a Falcon 9, but it's fully reusable, so it needs to be even larger than Falcon 9. So yeah, it's sort of, as you said, it's like this transition from Falcon 9 to Starship, but obviously both downscaled,
right.
one to 1 ton launcher, and then the other one to about 20 tons to low Earth orbit. But again, the one, you know, the 20 ton to low Earth orbit that Terran R rocket is fully reusable, so it needs to be larger in order to incorporate that, you know, all the dry mass into recovery systems and all of that, lowers performance, so you need a bigger rocket. And yeah, it's probably going to be maybe in between Vulcan and New Glenn in terms of the size, most likely. Just
the size
out of the top of my head. Yeah. In terms of the size, I think it's probably in between Vulcan and New Glenn. So you can imagine, we're talking about a rocket that is smaller than Falcon 9 and like maybe the same size as Alpha from Firefly, going from that to one that is even larger than Vulcan. So, yeah.
Certainly a big step for that company. Just to recap here, since it was asked, how will Terran R actually be recovered for the second stage? Like, did they already detail what kind of reusability they are going for with the second stage?
I don't think they have talked about that yet.
Yeah, I don't believe they have either.
Yeah, they will probably be some updates about that in the future, most likely, but so far they haven't really said much about that second stage. The first stage we know
is certainly guaranteed.
Yeah, they said they have like new materials, secret materials that they can 3D print that will mean no heat shield. We'll see about that.
So yeah. Heat shield built in. So he's still in.
Yeah, it's like,
still there.
It's like a Stoke with a heat shield on the bottom with all the thrusters and everything. It's still a heat shield. It's just a little bit more innovative kind of thinking there.
Feels a bit like a technicality where like we integrated the heat shield into your shield. They're like, okay, so you have a heat shield. It's just in a different place.
Yeah, it's just little tiles and things like that, but it's still there.
Amiga Clone asking here, do you know if there was any specific reason for methane being ignored as a rocket fuel? And I can actually take the first part of that because I did an article back in like 2022 with Thomas about that. And there's a multitude of reasons. One, of course, is the push to Mars, where it just makes sense to have methane as a fuel as it's generatable on that planet. So there's connection there, but there's also other reasons. For example, methane has a bit more problems with combustion stability, which was a problem they experienced in the past and which prevented methane to being used. So that's like two of the reasons why methane was not considered an RP-1, for example, was preferred.
And also, you got to understand the history of everything. Like, they first went with the easy kind of rocket fuels, which were like the nearest thing to jet fuel, like first jet fuel on some of the first orbital rockets, then like the nearest one is like a little bit more refined kerosene and things like that. And the immediate thinking was like, okay, now we're going to develop engines that are like on the highest performing engine, things like that, which were liquid hydrogen. So they didn't think about anything in between because they were laser focused on, you know, first we're going to learn how to actually make usable rocket engines with easier fuels, and then we're going to go for the higher performance, nothing in between. Then obviously as the industry evolved, hey, methane is here. It's kind of in the middle. So let's take it.
And another sort of idea in that swing that you had mentioned, Adrian, about like now the idea of Mars and pressing onward into the solar system, and it's where we can find it. Specifically, it's the carbon dioxide in Mars's atmosphere. It's the carbon dioxide in Earth's atmosphere, and the sort of abundance of that element throughout compound. Ooh, sorry, science teachers everywhere. That compound throughout the solar system, it's very common. And when you break that down, you get not only oxygen, but you get methane as well. So it's very easy to pull it from the atmosphere, scrub it from the atmosphere, pull it apart, and then put it back together in the components that you need it to. And there's some benefits to it as well in the rocketry design, because oxygen and methane have very similar temperatures at which they are liquid, as opposed to hydrogen and oxygen. So it makes common bulkheads a little bit easier than hydrolox rockets, even though they do exist in hydrolox rockets, but it does make it a little bit easier when your propellants have very similar temperatures in that regard.
There we go. Moving on here. Before we move to the next topic, I wanted to thank Jim Cavett, who gifted the one Red Team membership here. Thank you so much. And the lucky person who received that, make sure to thank Jim there in the chat. And also David Dean here with the $5 super chat and asking, do you think NASA intends to build its moon base on the recently named mountain near the lunar South Pole, Mons Mouton, given that's where Viper will scout?
Oh, good question. So they have not specifically determined like which one they're going to build at, but Shackleton is the one that gets mentioned quite a bit because it's got large indications of deposits of ice in the area. So Shackleton is probably a good bet, but one of the reasons that Viper is going to different places and that they're going to send the rovers to different places is sort of specifically for that, like go in situ, scout what's actually there, and then make your informed decision as to where you actually put the base.
There we go. I hope that answers your question, David, and thank you again for the super chat. Moving on to another methane rocket. It's really a methane-heavy episode today. With the ULA Vulcan update, Chris, there were some updates on Vulcan and the status of its progress to launch. What's the deal there?
Yes. As you said, continuing our round through the methane rockets today. So this is really important. So Vulcan is getting ready for rollout. So rollout for testing is upcoming. They don't have a precise date for it just yet, but it will be sometime soon. So Vulcan is currently inside of the vertical integration facility at SLC 41 at the Cape Canaveral Space Force Station, technically Kennedy Space Center property, on lease to Cape Canaveral, but, you know, minutia. But the reason they are going to be taking Vulcan out to the launch pad is for a series of demonstration and flight readiness tests. So there will be at least one tanking test, not a wet dress rehearsal, just a tanking test to fully validate the fueling systems for both the Vulcan and the Centaur upper stage. If you recall the test articles that were out there, there was a Vulcan first stage test article that was out there, but this is really the first time they're going to take the entire vehicle through everything. So that is why they're going to start with a tanking test. If the tanking test is successful or if it takes multiple tanking tests for them to get the data, then they move on to at least one wet dress rehearsal, which is basically everything but light the engines. And if they need to do more than one, they'll do more than one before proceeding down to a flight readiness firing of the two BE-4 engines. They will fire at 70% of a rate of performance for 3.5 seconds, held down onto the launch pad by the vertical, by the umbilical tower and launch stand itself. And really at this point, a good part of the pacing to the flight readiness review is those BE-4 engines. So Blue Origin is still taking them through the overall qualification sequence of tests on their test stands. And one of the previous, and the test is currently on pause right now because one of the latest ones, the oxygen pump actually overperformed by about 5% during an acceptance test firing. And an investigation into that basically revealed that that overperformance is within what's called the unit-to-unit deviation, meaning under nominal mission trajectories and performances, you would never this type of an overperformance would never deplete the oxygen tank, or get you into what's called a low level cutoff scenario where you've depleted the oxygen to the point where the sensors go, whoa, 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 we're running empty. We need to shut the engines down for safety. To keep them from exploding. So you would not see that during a normal flight performance. You could potentially get into a scenario where if you were far enough into the flight and you lost one of the BE-4 engines and you were burning the remaining one longer, that might run into an issue. But after flight 5 or 6 is what Tori said, is when that would become a problem. But they're understanding the issue. They're resuming the acceptance testing with it. And basically, now that they understand that, it's something that can be accounted for in the countdown and the oxygen load that goes into the vehicle and the overall understanding of how the engines are going to perform and drain the oxygen from the tank. So all of that gets us to the big question, right, Adrian and Alex? When launch, right?
Yes.
That's what we really want to know, right, is when launch, because it's assembled, it's got testing. So this is where its sequencing with Starliner becomes very important. Starliner has priority on the manifest for the latter half of April. So mid to late April, Starliner on an Atlas V has the priority. And then after that, Vulcan enters its 4-day launch window that opens on May 4th. So technically, the Vulcan will be ready by mid-April, but the Peregrine lunar launch trajectory window ends in early April, and the next one opens on May 4th. So they push to May 4th, and that gets you your opening launch date. The Peregrine lunar lander, the Kuiper satellites, and the Celestis memorial payloads that will be on board are all anticipated to be ready for the May 4th window. And then it will really just come down to, has Starliner lifted off? What's the priority here? Can Starliner scooch after it based on ISS? Based on ISS needs, and that will really sort of determine the overall sequencing here. But May 4th does appear to be the current target for Vulcan's debut flight.
Just want to instantly start with Paul Kelly's point about this here. Can we talk about how supremely disrespected it is to launch a Vulcan on Star Wars Day? And
I mean, April 5th would have been better, yes, but pesky mid-April readiness.
Yeah, it's like I feel that.
Just to like really dig in, like we should have Daniel Radcliffe say, "May the 4th be with you, Vulcan," and be dressed like Gandalf when he does it. Like that should just complete the, you know, yes, Adrian, look.
I'm in physical pain. Okay, let's move on from this very cursed question. Starship 24 asking, will Vulcan be able to have SRB configurations like Atlas V?
Ooh, to an extent, symmetrical. So it can have, so it has to have an even number of solids. It cannot have an odd number. So it can't be 1, 3, or 5. It's got to be either 2, 4, or 6. And that's for the symmetry of the thrust on the vehicle. So the BE-4s do not have the thrust vector control authority as the RD-180 does to counter that type of thrust from from the GEM 63XL solid rocket boosters, which are the uprated versions of the boosters that the Atlas V currently uses.
So we are not getting combinations like, for example, the big slider, where we have like one SRB.
No, if Vulcan power slides off the launch pad, something has gone very wrong. Okay. Yes.
There we go. Another question here. How much do each BE4 engine cost, and how much do they actually propellant cost? I do not think we know any of these numbers.
Nope.
As ULA and Blue Origin have, you could probably calculate fuel costs based on market values, but you cannot calculate the engine cost, I believe, because they probably do not share these.
That is exactly correct. It's a very good question, but Blue and ULA have absolutely not talked about that at all.
Yeah. I would be very curious. I understand that question, though, because it would be very interesting how much ULA pays for each BE4. That's definitely interesting.
Yeah, it would be interesting to also see what they pay for it versus what it costs, because contracts were signed quite a while ago for the BE4s, and the development program was not exactly smooth thereafter. So, but they got there, and that's the important part. They did get there. But it would be interesting to see that element of the relationship here.
I'm also, this is more a topic that I always think about, because it will be interesting down the line if New Glenn becomes operational and we have a situation where, for example, Vulcan and New Glenn will compete for certain missions, because suddenly you have the one side of Blue Origin who definitely has an interest to sell the engines, and the other side of Blue Origin has an interest to undercut the competition in price. So I feel like there's an interesting dynamic which might come up here in terms of competition.
And especially since the Space Force just amended how they are doing an SSL awards here last week. We actually haven't had a chance to talk about this on an NSF Live because it came up on the 16th. But they're basically creating two lanes. So the types of contracts that SpaceX and ULA won in the round two competitions are still in existence as lane two. But lane one sort of allows companies like Rocket Lab and Blue Origin, which can't prove that their rockets can get to all of the different orbits, and Rocket Lab especially, right? Like Rocket Lab, it would struggle to do a geostationary orbit insertion mission, right? Because of the size of the rocket. But they could certainly launch NSSL payloads into LEO, right? But because they can't do them all, they're excluded from bidding on any of them. And this is one of the things that the Space Force is changing. So Rocket Lab, Blue Origin, even if they can't, and you know, Relativity is included in this as well. Firefly Alpha is included in this as well. Even if their rockets can't go to all of the different orbits the Space Force needs, and that is still largely just Falcon, SpaceX and ULA, hey, all of these others could maybe do it for cheaper than they could, but you got to open up that competition, and they have, as a matter of fact. So yeah, how all of that interplay is going to happen now with how the NSSL awards are changing. And of course, some of the ones that SpaceX and ULA were awarded are now up for rebid as well under NSSL2 as part of this restructure. So also very interesting, because I'm really curious to see if Vulcan loses some of what it would have been awarded because it's not ready yet and because there have been some delays to it. But this also potentially benefits SpaceX too, with Starship's development and onboarding Starship to this overall. So like it's a very, as the Ferengi would say, lucrative move on behalf of the Space Force to open it up this way.
Yeah, and they also said it's also valuable because they said that they had expected for NSSL Phase 2, they expected somewhere around 30 launches. And now after, you know, adding some more launches and things like that, they have actually ended up with over 40 launches already for NSSL Phase 2. So for Phase 3, they're kind of thinking, you know, 60 or 70 might be on the docket for you know, to be able to share between all of these. And so they're thinking like lane two might be 30 to 40 launches, and then lane one might be 20 or even 30. So when you have so many launches that are like low risk, you can probably take that extra risk of, you know, going to the to the older folks that don't have much experience, and onboard new rockets as well, and diversify the fleet. That kind of makes sense as well, because you have a lot of launches, so you put more rockets.
And to be clear too, that SpaceX and ULA are not prohibited from bidding on lane one missions. They can still totally bid on them and could still totally win them. It's just opening them up to other bidders as well, like you said, Alex. Yeah.
There we go. And very regular super chatter here, Musical Wolves with the $5 super chat. Thank you so much for always being on these. It's very, very regular. Will ULA do a full duration test, like, for example, the SLS Green Run? I believe the answer is no, right, Chris?
No. So the qualification campaign that they are doing to say that the BE-4s are ready to lift off, so the two that are on board have undergone acceptance test firings, and then they're really doing test firings on qualification, on the final qualification engines that are built the exact same way as the ones on here are, and they're doing those at full duration firings on the test stands, and that's how they're qualifying the overall engines for first flight.
There we go. Also, it's time for me here by Ninja Decimator to merch by Alex, which we have an NSF sticker here. And we also have a Falcon Heavy shirt of the new Falcon Heavy collection. Very nice collection. I had that on for most of the last 3 days, always when I was here. But now I don't anymore. And also a launch entry landing, very on brand for tonight's Falcon 9 launch. So there we go.
Yeah.
Just making sure that we are displaying these. Also, we have a Wen Hop mug. I have that, but I'm right now drinking off my Wen Sleep. It's another very on-brand topic. And also an SLS mug.
I'm drinking from my mugs are dirty and in the dishwasher.
Yeah, at some point you have to like rotate, right? It's there's only so many mugs, but there's certainly a certain amount of coffee. So
exactly. Yes, it must be consumed each day. Yes.
Let's hit two more questions here before we move on. One question that is very on brand for China, so I can take that one. On methane rockets, do we have any updates on Zhukui 2's second attempt? The answer is no. So just for context, Zhukui 2 was the rocket that attempted to be the first methane rocket in orbit, but failed on about 3 kilometers a second short, so didn't enter orbit. But we saw pictures of the second flight being very like advanced and already advanced state, which all tanks and everything. But of course, that also depends on the investigation of what went wrong and what they need to change. So far, we have not heard a new launch target for Zhukui 2. Just to hit that quickly. And one final question here on Vulcan. Does ULA need to de-stack after the two qualification firing?
No, they do not need to destack Centaur and Vulcan. After the qualification firings and the flight readiness firings, once all of those are passed and they pull Vulcan from the actual launch pad, Vulcan will first go back to one of the storage facilities a bit further away from Pad 41, where the old Titan rockets were integrated together. And then the Atlas with Starliner, which will be stacked as well while Vulcan is out on the pad, will then come out of the vertical integration facility and take the pad for the Starliner launch. And then after that, Vulcan will come back to have payload integration. And then it will go out to the pad for its liftoff as well.
Certainly a very busy time for ULA coming up, which is good.
Yes, but a good moment for them to get used to shuffling between Atlas and Vulcan, because the Vulcan is bigger, so it has its own mobile launch tower and platform. So they're not sharing launch platforms, which is a large part of what enables this, as well as Vulcan's ability to do some of its stacking in one of the old Titan buildings as well. Now, they've done it all inside the vertical integration facility so far. They really have to get used to going back and forth between the two vehicles, because there's still about 18 or so Atlases left on the manifest to fly out as well as Vulcan comes online.
There we go. That certainly covers our part of Vulcan of the show, which certainly is entering a very interesting time here. So I'm looking forward to see a lot of Metalogs in the upcoming months, which it's definitely interesting because one slip can suddenly mean that another rocket is in the lead. So we will see how this all plays out. And good luck, of course, to Vulcan once it happens.
Because right now, Alex, Relativity and SpaceX are both March. The 8th of March for Relativity March. And SpaceX is March, as far as we know. and then Vulcan is May. So there's a distinct possibility that three methane rockets in 3 months could attempt their liftoffs.
Plus, also Circuit 2 might try as well because they had that issue in December, so maybe they're already back on track or something. We don't know, but they're certainly going to be attempting something soon, probably.
Yeah.
Interesting for sure. We also was very interesting was a launch to the International Space Station just a few days ago, which was the launch of the Soyuz MS-23. Alex, do you want to give us an overview why this launch was so interesting?
Yeah, so it was a weird launch because we didn't have any SpaceX launch, but we did have the Soyuz launch of the MS-23 spacecraft. And this one is actually replacing the MS-22 spacecraft that had a coolant leak back in December of last year. This mission was launched uncrewed without any sort of people on board. It did carry some cargo up to the International Space Station because they're already launching that, so why not? It seemed to go well so far. Docked to the International Space Station, all well, in automatic mode, as you can imagine, without any crew on board. But that is mostly what it usually does, the Soyuz, with a eventual rogue curse system not functioning sometimes. But that is very unusual and very unlikely, and it docked to the space station very well. This Soyuz will now be so. The crew on board the ISS will now swap the seats for liner from Soyuz MS-22, at least for the two cosmonauts, from Soyuz MS-22 to Soyuz MS-23. Frank Rubio's seat liner was on Crew Dragon, I think it's Endurance, as like a fifth seat of sorts on board the capsule. So now it's going to be transferred to the new vehicle, Soyuz MS-23. And Soyuz MS-22 will eventually undock. It will re-enter nominally. They will gather the data that they can from that, just basically seeing how it performs during free flight and during return. Sadly, the section with the coolant leak is not it doesn't survive re-entry, so they are not able to perform any actual hands-on testing on it. They have to test that remotely and see how's the performance of Soyuz without all of that coolant on board. But so far, we'll see. That's sort of the plan right now. The Soyuz MS-23 will also remain on station for the foreseeable future for like 6 months, as a usual Soyuz will do. The difference for the crew, obviously, is that they have been already 6 months on the ISS. So now they're going to keep going for another 6 months, and they're going to be staying up there for a year. So I think that's actually the first time that like the full complement of a Soyuz has stayed up there for a year. We've seen some missions that have been there for like 9, 10, 11 months. But this is going to be the first one, like the whole crew is going to stay up there for those 12 months. So it's going to be kind of interesting to see what data comes out of it, because I suppose they're going to take advantage of that to take also some data on, long duration space flights and things like that.
There we go. We have some questions about this. First off, Tony saying MS-23 messes with my launch stats. Is it crewed or not, given it has a landing crew? That's an interesting edge case because, it's not crewed first, and then it becomes crewed.
It's also not the first time this happened, though. There was a thing in the 80s or maybe the 90s, maybe the 80s, because it was a Salyut station. They had an issue with the engine on, I think it was Soyuz 32, and it was Soyuz 33, the one that they launched as rescue, sort of like replacement. I think it's sort of those numbers. Again, don't recall, like I'm literally saying this off the top of my head, but you can Google that maybe, just the numbers and things like that. But yeah, it happened before that they have launched an uncrewed Soyuz just to replace a previous one. It's also not the first time that they've launched an uncrewed Soyuz in general. This is actually, I think, the third time in the recent times. So there's been that Soyuz replacement. There was also a Soyuz TMA that was launched uncrewed as a test demo of that capsule. And then there was also a Soyuz MS launched, the Soyuz MS-14, that was also launched in August 2019 to the ISS for some similar purposes of like testing about
validating Soyuz, the Soyuz rocket.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. Well, on the one hand, it was because they were looking into an uncrewed Soyuz variant for cargo and things like that. But also, I remember that as well, they were also testing the new rocket, the Soyuz 2.1A, that is now used for these crewed launches.
And it was a really interesting reason they had to test it. It wasn't that Soyuz might not be able, like the Soyuz capsule might not be able to talk to the Soyuz rocket. It's that the Soyuz crew capsules have never launched before on a rocket that could perform the roll maneuver to get onto the proper azimuth like the Soyuz 2.1As can. And they literally needed to make sure that the Soyuz capsules systems would not trigger an in-flight abort when the rocket started to roll. And that was the largest reason for launching that one uncrewed. Yeah.
Yeah. It happened once, or maybe I'm misremembering that one time, long time ago in the Soyuz history, where the launch escape system activated just because the rocket was sitting on the pad. I think they had to scrap the launch or something like that. It's remembering.
Yes, but that was actually like the engines lit. They had to shut down, but there was a legitimate problem on the ground, and the escape system did trigger.
I'm thinking of another one where it triggered. It was uncrewed, and the reason for that was that the Earth had been rotating. So in the time that they actually it was an uncrewed mission of a test Soyuz, and the launch was aborted, and the way that the capsule actually measures those things is the angles and things like that, and the Earth had been rotating because it rotates, and so the time passed, and there was a point where the capsule was like, hey, I'm moving, right? And so it basically sensed that and activated the launch escape system. It was weird, one-off, but it can happen that, because your rocket is a little bit off. So obviously when you have a rocket that now can finally roll like that one, you obviously do those kind of tests.
One question we have here from Adrian, nice name, by the way, is what's the guarantee that this Soyuz won't spring a leak? I haven't heard of them identifying what caused the leak. Was there actually like a deep investigation into this?
It's been kind of mixed signals from Roscosmos because they've been talking about micrometeorites like and orbital debris, like MMODs, as we usually say. And the thing is, the issue with the Progress MS-21, I think it is, and the Soyuz MS-22, the locations are very similar. So that prompts the question, like, how are the chances, right, that it's so close in the location of the radiator loops that these incidents happened, right? And so it's a little bit complicated to think that it is both cases MMODs and not something else, but they haven't really said anything else other than we'd look into it with capture photos and things like that, and it's MMOD, and it's like, okay, but isn't there any possibility that it's still up in the air? But
there we go. Hope that answers your question. We hope, of course, it won't spring another leak. And this one is fine without any problems. Before we move on here, I want to thank Dougal for 5 Red Team memberships gifted. Make sure, I already saw some people saying thank you to Dougal. Thank you so much for that, Dougal. And yeah, I hope people enjoy their membership perks, such as exclusive like access to some photos, some high-res photos in the membership area, which is always nice to see. So let's move on here to our, I think, the big topics in terms of what like happens very, very soon, which is the crew launch of tonight. SpaceX Crew 6 coming up. Chris, want to give us an overview about what we expect tonight?
Yes, indeed. So brand new Falcon 9 rocket is set to launch the Endeavour capsule on its 4th trip to the International Space Station after previously flying Demo 2, Crew 2, and Axiom 1. On board will be 4 international crew members, Commander Stephen Bowen, who is a NASA astronaut and a 3-time veteran of space shuttle missions STS-126, 132, and 133. Fun fact, he is the only person in the shuttle era to fly back-to-back space shuttle missions on 132 and 133. And he will be joined, but this is his first long-duration mission to the International Space Station, so that is important to note. His others were up and down on the exact same mission. And he will be joined by 3 rookies. So joining him is pilot Woody Hoberg from NASA. And also joining is mission specialist Saltan Al-Niadi from the United Arab Emirates and mission specialist Andrei Fedyaev from Russia. Also, a happy 42nd birthday to Andrei today. So missing out by a launch on his birthday by 1 hour and 45 minutes, but I think suiting up and going to the launch pad counts, and we can give that to him today. But the crew has been at the Kennedy Space Center for about a week. They completed their dry dress rehearsal, basically the crew's walkthrough of launch day. They completed that early Thursday morning, and then SpaceX teams then stepped into fueling the rocket without the crew on board and conducted the static fire at 5:45 a.m. on Thursday morning. That was completed with booster B1078, which is a first flight booster. And again, Endeavour making its Dragon record 4th flight to space today. But Alex, I want to turn it over to you for this next part, because there were some issues and some open items that were discussed at the flight readiness reviews and launch readiness reviews as well for this particular mission.
Yeah, so prior to the static fire test and the dry dress rehearsal, they conducted a flight readiness review with NASA, like SpaceX, NASA, and all the partners of the International Space Station. And some of the open items, like one of the things that I think stood out for me was the presence of an engine fire, more like fire in the engine bay on booster 1062, which had flown on the previous Starlink mission, Starlink 5-4. I'm kind of looking at the notes here as well. And that mission, apparently the sender engine had a fire in the engine bay. And so they had been looking at it. It was sort of an open item. The booster had also come back to port like 2 days before or something like that. So it was very fresh data that they had seen already. So they needed a little bit more of time there. They went into the static fire test. One of the things that they mentioned afterwards, after the launch readiness review, which occurred yesterday, and after the static fire, what they mentioned was that they think that the cause of the fire might come down to a leak on an oxygen, like on a joint, a leak of oxygen on one of the joints on that section of the booster. And it appears that also the boot, basically the engine, is protected by some kind of cloth there to protect it from re-entry and also for ascent. And that engine boot had been already flown all 12 flights that the booster had been flying. The booster is a very, very high flight number, 12 flights already compared to this one, which is first flight. And one of the things that they also found out, it's that boot might have basically had residuals in it that have contributed to the fire as well. It was a small fire. It didn't affect the engine performance. It did well, like it landed perfectly with, another streak of I think it was the 99th successful landing in a row for that, for the Falcon program. So it didn't affect the performance of the booster, but it obviously, you know, you see that. And one of the questions on these conferences was, have you seen this on other boosters? And they were like, yeah, the other boosters that even have more flights, we have much more data and everything, haven't presented this. So obviously we wanted to take a look and make sure that this wasn't present on the booster flying on this mission. So they did the static fire, they leak test those joints to make sure that, you know, there wasn't any leak or anything, and they cleared the issue perfectly. But definitely something to know that, you know, sometimes these little issues appear on the boosters. And the overall theme of these conferences was actually that, you know, both NASA and SpaceX are very glad that, you know, SpaceX has these high cadence of flights. These starting flights help them a lot to gather data. These high booster numbers as well, that they can fly them many times, so they're able to gather all of these data ahead of flights and be sure that everything is safe. That's definitely something that they can say it's a great advantage. One of the exciting things, well, not exciting, but more like interesting things that I also found out from that conferences was that there were questions about what SpaceX might have done to protect Dragon from MMODs, just like Soyuz and Progress have, you know, leaks and things like that. And one of the things that they mentioned is that the radiator loops are, you know, they have two radiator loops. They are redundancy, like they have redundancy on board them, but also they have tested, you know, hitting the thrusters, like the Draco thrusters, with MMODs, like simulated MMODs, and having holes in the chambers of these thrusters and firing them, and they were fired successfully without any sort of repercussion to the vehicles or anything. So that seemed to me very interesting. Sleek 40 tower construction underway with foundations already put in place. The critical design review phase right now is where they stand right now with the crew access tower, the arm and everything. And it should be ready for cargo flights in Q3 of this year and cargo and crew flights a little bit later. I think I hit sort of the most important. There were a couple of more things, but these are like the few things that stood out for me at least.
There we go. That was a quite juicy update from you both on Crew 6. So if everybody wanted to prepare for the launch later, there you go. But we have some questions here. With Crew 6 Endeavour already flown 4 times, do we know what the expected limit for Crew Dragon is and how much it can fly?
I could hit that one because Right now they are certified for 5 flights. SpaceX wants to extend that certification all the way to 15 flights for Crew Dragon and Cargo Dragon. So both Cargo Dragon and Crew Dragon are for those 5 flights are certified for 5 flights right now. But yeah, as mentioned, they want to extend it all the way to 15 so that they can basically put in place, you know, many, many flights in those capsules so that they are able to launch many times. There's a very, well, not healthy because it's still not in full-fledged, but let's say that there's a lot of promising things in the horizon for Crew Dragon in terms of missions between, you know, Axiom, Polaris missions, and then also in the future commercial LEO destinations. So there's definitely room for more missions to pop up, and that will definitely help. One thing that I remember, though, I didn't put this on the notes, but there are new Teslas for Crew 6. So they have new black Teslas.
Yes, yeah.
And apparently they were asked about that, and they said it in very basic terms that because they have more missions now, they also have more vehicles, more cars. And so they have more diverse fleet of white and black cars, you know, with different logos and different histories. So not only the capsules, but also the cars seem to have certifications, so to speak. Obviously joking, but yeah, they seem to also have like...
Hey, we're running out of sticker space on the windshield.
Yeah, like, exactly.
It becomes a safety hazard with too many stickers. It's like, you can't see anymore. We have a question here by Autos Mancho, which I think also might touch on the shuttle topic we sometimes mention here on the show, which is, had there ever been an international pilot on an American craft other than the Axiom mission?
No, and that was the first.
There we go. I was not sure about the shuttle missions, if there was ever like a none. So there we go on that.
No.
I was thinking, wait, what Axiom mission? And then I remember Michael.
Yeah, and... yeah, but no, in terms of an international pilot, the shuttle never had that, because the qualifications to be a pilot and a commander of the shuttle was that you had to be a U.S. military officer. So by definition, you were going to be a U.S. citizen to be a commander or a pilot on a shuttle flight.
And soon there will be, so we had obviously...
And there are no such restrictions for... Yeah. Dragons and Starliners and Orions. Yeah. And in exactly. fact, in Starliner, Sunny Williams will be it will mark the first time that a woman will fly on the first orbital crew flight of a new launch vehicle in history.
And the interesting thing is that, because it dawned on me that, you know, Michael, Axiom 1, but for NASA missions, I think it is Crew 7, the one where Andreas Mogensen, basically an ESA astronaut, is going to be a pilot for that Crew Dragon. So an European being pilot of an American spacecraft is like, hey, you know,
first time,
kind of a big deal. That's going to be exciting.
Oh, Europe. Sorry. another question here about Dragon and its capacity. Is there any plans, or will they ever fly a Dragon with a full crew of 7? Is there a
very important caveat here? Full crew for Dragon is 4. Above that is the contingency carrying capability that the capsules can do under non-nominal situations.
So there's no plan right now, as we know, of any mission or anything where they would launch with more than 4.
Not now. No. The design for the extra seats was not continued beyond 4, but they can carry more if they need to. And of course, with enough lead time, SpaceX could make something possible, but not right now. No.
And let's hope we never see a Crew Dragon carry more than 4 down, because otherwise that would mean serious issues.
Yeah, it means something's gone very wrong and they weren't able to get to the Soyuz. Yeah.
As I said, Frank Rubio had that, basically his seat liner was underneath the row of 4 seats. I think it was the one on the left if you are looking at the controls. So that is basically where it was sitting. And yeah, if that were to happen one day, that means there's an emergency up there on the ISS, and we don't want that.
Let's say I hit one final question here about Crew 6. If you have more Crew 6 questions, though, after this, make sure to turn into our webcast of that, because we will broadcast, of course, the Crew 6 mission, and you will be able to ask anything you want there over the whole cast. So
that
we will answer anything.
And you can join us at 10 p.m. Eastern, 3 UTC, for that live coverage of the Crew 6 launch.
I hate sleep anyways.
I won't be sleeping until I drive back home after launch, so there you go.
Yeah, it's going to be a long night for a lot of people. So there we go. One final question here. How long will Crew 6 be in space?
Approximately 6 months.
There we go. That's the usual duration for these crew rotations, right? It's like always about 6 months,
exactly,
give or take.
There sometimes, depending on the mission, might be like 5, just because they want to like schedule missions a little bit left and right in their manifest. But yeah, it's usually 6 months.
Okay, let me hit what Kevin bought here in our shop first before we move on, because we have some more possibilities to show what people bought here. We have, that's a good one. That's a Delta for a heavy metal print. That's a great decision right there, Kevin. What a brilliant idea to do.
Yeah.
I'm not biased at all, but what a brilliant decision. How fitting that I get the Delta for heavy right here. So let's move on here.
With
what also, yeah.
How also much did you pay him for that purchase?
Yeah, my alternative name is also Kevin. It's like, there we go. And also we have a $5 super chat here by Dave, who said he bought bacon. Congratulations on that bacon. It's a very reoccurring topic on our cast, but Jack sadly is not here today. So it's the bacon specialist is missing. What is no longer missing is something we added to our shop recently, which is very fitting to what is happening tonight. Because if you go to the metal print section in our shop, you will now see three brand new Falcon 9 metal prints, which are by Brady, Pauline, and Nathan, our photographers, added to the shop. Because we noticed, yeah, there's a certain lack of Falcon 9 in our metal prints, which because sometimes they feel like so routine, but of course it's a gorgeous rocket we want to showcased as well with the amazing photography. So make sure to check out shop.nasaspaceflight.com and check out these new Falcon 9 metal prints or any other metal print you might want to have on your wall. I can certainly tell you I like them, as you can see behind me. So yeah, make sure to check out the shop. Moving on to a very special Starlink mission, which is interesting because usually Starlinks are became kind of routine, but what is so special about Starlink 6-1, Alex?
Yeah, so we talk about how we're not gonna sleep a lot, but then also there's more launches after Crew 6. There's a Starlink 6-1, there's a Starlink 2-7. It's gonna be tomorrow, it's gonna be crazy. But yeah, one of them is this, I think it is in the right direction, which Starlink 6-1 is going to launch the first Starlink V2 satellites. And you might wonder, oh, this is a Falcon 9. This we're going to be launching on Starship. Are they even able to fit those satellites into Falcon 9? Well, they can fit them because they have downsized them, basically. They are size for the Falcon 9 fairing envelope. And you can see here, there are like 21, there are 21 on that stack, and they are larger, like they fit the whole thing. Instead of being like 2 and 2, they're more like the whole thing for each layer. And this time, these satellites actually include higher performance, phased array antennas. Okay. Well, that's later.
Also that.
More powerful phased array antennas. They also add E-band to their, like they have K-band, Q-band, and now they also have E-band. A lot of different frequencies to talk to the ground, you know, and in between the satellites, they still have the laser links as well. That is something that hasn't changed from V1.5. But the thing is, these are larger, they are less, but they are also they have more performance. So there's like three times less satellites instead of like the usual 50 to 52 satellites that we see on regular Starlink V1.5 launches. This is going to carry 21, which is about a third, but they also have like four times the capability, the data throughput. So in overall, every launch of these satellites is going to carry even more more capability than the previous ones. So it makes sense because a Starship right now is going to launch soon, but the first launch and even the second or third might not even carry Starlink satellites. So we're still probably a year until Starship launches any Starlink satellites. In the meantime, they can launch them on Falcon 9, and they have a healthy cadence of flights, so why not, right? These satellites include new Hall effect thrusters. They also had Hall effect thrusters on the previous version, but those were based on krypton. So these are based on argon, and they are 2.4 times the thrust and 1.5 the specific impulse, and I'm merchpied right now because why not? And so the good thing of this is that usually in the industry, they build the thrusters, the ion thrusters, they are built for xenon gas. The problem is the supply of xenon is not really that high on Earth. So if you want to build a thousands and thousands of satellites that use xenon, you cannot carry these fuel as a fuel on board the vehicles. So they instead developed krypton thrusters. These are like krypton is cheaper, it's more available, more surplus around the Earth and everything. But here they're gonna launch almost 7 times more satellites, and they're heavier and things like that. So they needed something. It seems like the decision here is obviously that argon is even more accessible, is the third most frequent gas in the atmosphere, right? So if you have an Earth separation unit, which Starbase fans might know that SpaceX has one at a Starbase, those can be used to separate the air into at least most of these components, which are nitrogen, oxygen, and also argon. So even they themselves could even produce their own argon for these thrusters. So it's very, very beneficial for them to switch from krypton to argon. And it's not that, oh, why haven't they thought about this before? You know, why not? Maybe they were like, why not use it now? No one thought about it. Now, it's just like methane, right? We were also talking about that earlier. So same thing with argon.
There we go.
What I also love about this photo, Adrian, is you can see the other stacks behind it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, true. There's like another stack. Just
another one.
I just blew your mind. I could tell that. Like, oh, wait, it's like, not a mirror.
It's also like very fitting.
I think those are actually the previous version, because I see a lot of them might be more Starlink V1.5 satellites, because even though they're launching, so this is important to clear out, even though they're launching V2, this doesn't mean they're stopping the others, you know, they're not stopping launches of the others. One thing I will say, though, recently, and I saw paperwork about this, SpaceX asked the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, they asked them for when they have to replace and replenish the first generation constellation, whether they could launch these mini satellites, these Starlink V2 mini satellites, in sort of like substitution of them, which is going to be interesting, because it probably means that they're going to keep both constellations at the same time, even when they are replacing satellites from the older one. We'll see.
There we go. Yeah, it would be very not... because they probably have some satellites on storage still of these older constellations, so it makes sense to also use them, right? Instead of just making a hard cut. Do we know the altitude orbit of these V2 Starlink satellites for the 6-1 mission?
Ooh, hold up. I have it right here. So the orbit that they are going to be inserted to is 365 by 373 at 43 degree inclination. We're going to talk about this on the launch webcast, by the way. But the target orbit, the one that they are going to be later going up to, is at 540 kilometers in altitude. That's the altitude that they are going to be operating at.
There we go. I think we talked about the argon thrusters. One final question here. Can you tell me more about Starshield, which is very related to this topic? Is it Starlink or a new version? So what's Starshield exactly? Because we have talked about it before, just a quick summary here.
Good question. I think that's basically all that I can say, because we haven't really been told what exactly it is. It seems like it might be based on Starlink, but it's not a Starlink. Like, it's sort of the same similar concept of flat packed and things like that, but it doesn't seem to be the exact same design, at least from like one picture and one render that we have of that. Like, there's literally nothing else other than that one picture of one in orbit and then one render with like two solar arrays or things like that. So we'll see.
There we go. Musical Wolves here with the $5 super chat. What happens to the remove before flight tags for the Starlings? Do they get reused? That's a good question. I'm not sure if there's reusability for remove before flight tags, but it would be on brand for SpaceX to reuse the tags, I would say. So there we go. That you can see. I think you can see it on the right side, right? Kind of cool to see with the red. Let's move on to one more methane, which is the last topic of today, and of course we always like to talk about it. Alex, there's this certain shiny rocket that we sometimes talk about, Starship. What's the deal with that? What's happening there?
So you're in luck because I was actually part of the upcoming Starbase update video that should be releasing tomorrow, hopefully. I hope you'll like it, by the way. So one of the things that they did today, this week was testing Ship 26, which is right here. And they cryo-proofed the vehicle. It seems like so far it didn't seem to go like, you know, popping or anything. But a weird vehicle. We might touch about that on the questions probably. But yeah, it seemed to go without any sort of issues at first glance. Some of the other stuff that we have also seen here is the orbital launch mount getting shields as well. So the orbital launch mount has started being covered with shields on its sides. And so one of the important things ahead of that launch is that, you know, they have the FireX, the concrete doesn't really get that much damage and everything. But obviously once the rocket lifts off, you need to cover the OLM. And we have talked about that on many Starbase live streams as well, that, you know, are they going to cover that? Are they going to be doing anything? And obviously it was about time, right? There's like a mess of pipes and other stuff right there. So it was about time that they did that. And also, let me see through here as well. I think, Adrian, we also have released a very fancy video featuring you as well with a thrust and countdown analysis.
And there were some interesting talking points. For details, check, of course, out that video. But there were some interesting numbers about, since we now know the thrust numbers of Booster 7 during its test and how much more it actually will produce during the orbital flight, because there's quite a difference there. There were some interesting numbers crunching then. We are getting very close to being very able to say how long fueling will take for booster and during the countdown, which will probably be in a ballpark of 1 hour and 20 minutes. So that was kind of interesting to analyze. And I'm really glad I got that opportunity to really dig into some numbers again, because from time to time, I really like to do that. So yeah, checked out that video.
Another thing that we saw this week as well was also the removal of Ship 25 from Pad B. And at first it was like, okay, they're removing this, but what are they doing with it? They sent it back to the production site. And it was like, is it going to be a scrap? We were hoping that it was just that, you know, they were kind of removing it because they were going to be the launch and everything. And so they were kind of hiding the ships from all the fury and everything. But it seems like it went to Massey up the road. So after it went to the production site, then it went down on another closure. It went to Massey. And it might be tested there. We don't know. It might be that it's actually testing the new stuff going on there. So we'll see. Could be either way, right? Definitely lots and lots of things. Speaking of, we were talking about Starlink as well. And one of the other things that we saw was Starlink satellites on one of the buildings. I believe we can show that soon. Come on. I'm waiting for Michael to hit it because that's the orbital launch mount shields. There we go. That's the Starlink loader. They load the Starlinks there and everything. And one of the interesting things that we saw here is a rig. Like, it seems like it is to basically load the Starlinks from whatever they're stacked to and then put it inside of the box. And that is very interesting because it means that they might be close to, you know, going into more of a payload integration testing soon as well. On that same note, Ship 26 was also stacked in the high bay. And the interesting thing about that relationship between Starlink and Ship 27 is that Ship 24 and Ship 25 have payload bays, but both are sealed off. Ship 26 doesn't have a payload bay, but Ship 27 does have a payload bay. So will we see the first Starlink launches on Ship 27? don't know, but we'll see. And we can also see here a test nose cone lifted on the test rig. That is also another thing that we're looking for. More testing on that nose cone as well. It is a Pathfinder nose cone. Not sure yet whether they're fully testing. Obviously, this is the first test of the new nose cone, which seems a little bit like untimely, might be the word, that they are now testing it when they have Ship 24 about to launch into orbit. Seems kind of counterintuitive, but yeah. So I think I hit all the important yes. points for the Starbase. Yeah, they replaced the HPUs, the hydraulic power units on Booster 7. They put the arrow covers on them as well. You know, a lot of activity at the Starbase, and all of it centered around that important flight that we're looking for might happen next month. And, you know, finishing touches on everything around the place and preparing next vehicles like Ship 26, Ship 25, Ship 27. Other boosters. I think we also saw parts for Booster 10 going into the Mega Bay as well. Might be stacked soon. Overall, very, very packed and very, very intensive week at a Starbase. They do not stop.
It feels crazy how you just said in a sentence, in a very short sentence, like Ship 24, which is very close to launch, which is like it's also there's this orbital attempt coming up. Like there's so much they're doing everywhere. Of course, we see here the shielding of the orbital launch mount being installed, for example. But yeah, this launch is coming really, really close now. And along the fact that it doesn't feel crazy anymore to say it might launch like next month, right, Chris?
Not really, to a large extent. I mean, still a few ways to go on a couple things, but yeah, I mean, next month still definitely a technical possibility. Yes.
So let's hope that happens. There's a question by Musical Wolves here. Any news on the launch license? Do we have any news on the launch license?
News per se. So by the way, this view is live. I just noticed because it's save as the one on SPL.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, that's live. And so the launch license, the problem with it, it's that the news about it, while it is being processed, all that they can say is that, yes, it's in work. They cannot say it is X close because I don't even think they're fully, you know, aware of when things might be close. Obviously, they probably have some indications of when things might be closed out for that license. But obviously, we won't know publicly anything until it is fully finished and granted. One thing I will say, though, there's sometimes these conspiracies of they won't announce it until we're very, very close to launch. If that were to happen, it's going to be pure coincidence that it was granted very, very close to launch, because the FAA is a federal agency, and these sorts of things, they are sort of basically they have to release these things to the public as soon as they are granted, sort of also like the FCC licenses and things like that. And you can find it on their website as well. And I actually trialed this with Terran 1 because Terran 1 got its launch license. And it was on the website just the day it was released. So we should expect the same thing to happen with the Starship. And obviously, just like Relativity tweeted, hey, we have the launch license. I wouldn't be surprised if SpaceX went like, hey, we have the launch license, when they are granted that launch license. So don't fret, just be patient about it. And, you know, there's still work to do. So it's not like if they were granted the launch license tomorrow, they will be able to launch tomorrow, right? There's still work to do. We don't even know if there might be some testing left. We know that at least major testing, it seems like they are done with it. But last week, we saw that QD testing and the spin prime and all that, little testing that they usually do, you know, in order to nail down and kind of refine things, that is probably not unexpected, at least, in my opinion. Yes. We'll see.
Yeah, I think so far, no one at SpaceX or at the NASA or anything, like, nobody has, like, voiced any concerns Like, nobody has said publicly, like, oh no, we think the launch license might be a blockade. And as long as we don't hear that, I'm not really worried, because SpaceX in the past, and especially Elon Musk in the past, has been very vocal if agencies get into the way of launching. So as long as we don't hear, like, anything where somebody is worried or voices concerns, I feel like that's not really a pacing item yet. At least that's my feeling about this.
Yeah, I think Shotwell said recently on a conference that she expects the launch license to drop this March. So, like, they're going to be very close together, that, you know, as they are ready for launch, they're also going to get that launch license as well. So if she thinks like that, maybe we'll see.
Well, how soon before the first Falcon 9 flight did they get the launch license?
Well, that is complicated, because the launch license was also so the launch itself was also pending some certification of the FTS system for Falcon 9 for that first flight. So I'm not fully sure yet on, like, the exact date on when that happened, but I can tell you that, the for example, things like the environmental assessment happened like a year before the launch. So seeing Starship launching a whole year after the environmental assessment was completed, which was June of last year. Remember when we thought that was going to be an issue? So, you know, it's not really unheard of, because these things usually are done way before the rocket is ready. Obviously, SpaceX was expecting that, you know, they weren't going to be ready much closer, but, you know, it is what it is.
They always, when you mentioned the environmental assessment, I just remember 4 hours of PDF reading, which was by far the most interesting.
It was the most riveting stream we've ever done. Yeah, we read a PDF, like, for 5 hours. Yeah.
And I love the moment where we all went like, I mean, we can just read all of this, I guess. And then we just did that.
Gospel it up on the screen, telestrating it. Like, it was awesome.
That was a very, very cool
I enjoy screen. It.
Yes, that was very cool. Let's hit some question here. Methane Man, very fitting name for this, asking, where would the best place to watch this launch be? South Padre Island?
Yep.
Yeah, it's with this
easy
U shape, kind of. Yes. So, yeah, South Padre Island, probably the space to go. So we'll see how many people. I feel like it will be a bit busy. Once that happens,
I hope they are prepared for it. I don't really think they have an idea what's about to descend on them. People wise, like, not rocket. But yeah,
I feel like everybody probably at that space is like, I mean, yeah, it's a test launch of a rocket. There would be some people probably coming over to cover it. I feel like there might be some underestimation how many people are interested in this first flight. Also, I don't think there's an ability to even build an infrastructure that quickly to support so many people. So it will be a buzzing time there.
It's also spring break, right? Like,
very close to spring break if they go in March. Yes, it just all the things. Yes,
the perfect storm. Okay, we're getting very close now to where we would wrap the show. I want to hit like one or two more questions here. Metagon asking, any predictions when Starship 24 will go back to the full stack? I'm lacking any timeline for that, because we have not heard anything about how close to launch that might happen. Any predictions here?
I haven't. I could see. But I would caution you that there's nothing that says it has to be stacked for a long period of time before liftoff. And there's also nothing that says they can't stack it relatively close to liftoff either. There's no payload on it. The only thing they need to do is connect the upper, essentially there's more than that. I'm simplifying this, extremely, but like the big thing they have to do is connect the quick disconnect arm to it. So, you know, just I think it'll ultimately just come down to the sequencing of the tests and the activities that they're doing and when it makes sense to actually put it on top of the booster.
Yeah, I agree with you there. So I think it's not a hugely, like a very big watch item right now, because we have seen them stacking very fast in the past. It's basically after rollout, they can do it in a few hours.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if like they roll it out a little bit early and then stack it closer to launch. Because if you think about it, when they roll these ships, those tiles, sometimes they get a little of a ride on that road because it's not perfect, that road. And sometimes you see cracked tiles. And obviously you wouldn't want to launch that thing. If at least you care about the reentry, you wouldn't want that to happen, you know, and like see that cracked tile, then stack it and then launch. So I wouldn't be surprised if that were to happen, that they roll it a little bit early, they inspect that everything is okay, and then stack it and launch.
There we go. And I think with that, we are on point to we kind of went really good with the timing here for the show, because we arrived at the end of our show. And before we wrap, I want to make sure to thank some members here, because at this point we have a lot of launch directors and flight engineers here, you can see, but not only those, but also our like red team at Capcom. Thanks to our members, you're really making this possible. So yeah, thank to you all, and search for your name here on the screen if you're a launch director, flight engineer. It's quite a lot and it's quite busy at this point. Thank you so much. And with that, I want to say thank you to Chris Gephardt. Thanks for being on the show, Chris.
My pleasure, and see you in a few hours for Crew 6.
Absolutely. And I also want to thank Alex for being here. Alex, thank you so much for all that amazing SpaceX insight.
Oh, boy. I hope at least we see more than one launch tomorrow. We'll see what happens. But definitely look out for those streams. At least the two from Florida, we're going to be there streaming. So do look out for those.
And also, I want to thank Mr. Michael Baylor in the background, making sure we have all of these amazing scenes always ready, making sure we look good here presenting. So thank you, Michael, for being here as well. And I have been Adrian Bile for NASA Space Flight, and we see you all the next time.
10 p.m.